Well, thank you very much, Assemblywoman People Stokes, for that very kind introduction. I'm delighted to be here. I have to get this off my chest. Buffalo is very special to me. You know, my oldest brother lived most of his life here and passed in 95 of rheumatoid arthritis. But there are a lot of people from both sides of my family who, for one reason or another, ended up in Buffalo. So when I was growing up in Alabama and had not been out of Alabama, the place that I heard about all the time was Buffalo. And then some of you know that when I finished medical school in Cleveland, I first went to Rochester at Strong Memorial Hospital, and that's where I did my initial training in medicine and pediatric hospital training. It's just a special feeling. I was back in Rochester yesterday, spoke there yesterday, and Rochester has an award that they give every year to faculty members who make the greatest contribution to improving the health of the community. And 9 years ago, they named that award for me. Because when I was a resident there, they had trouble getting me to stay put in the hospital. I was always out. I was out at the Jordan Health Center. And so I got quite involved in the community and learned as much in the community as I did in the hospital, by the way. So it was a great experience. And that's been the story of my career. When I went out to Los Angeles, had an opportunity to really get involved in the community and develop a free clinic at Second Baptist Church. So it's good to be here. I really appreciate what New York State has done, what you all have done, in really highlighting the need for all of us, but especially our young people, to know more about mental health. And to appreciate the importance of mental health. You know, none of us can take our mental health for granted. I said that in 99 when we released the Surgeon General's report on mental health. It was the first ever report from the Office of the Surgeon General on mental health. You know, we had had reports on smoking and health that I think made a great difference in the lives of Americans. We had a lot of reports, but we had never had a Surgeon General's report on mental health. I became Surgeon General in February of 1998. And by the end of 1999, we had completed the Surgeon General's report on mental health, but also we had completed a report on suicide prevention. So these are all of the reports. Well, not all, I guess, but most of the reports that I completed when I was Surgeon General. And as you can see, among those reports, there are three right there on mental health, but there was also the report on overweight and obesity, and a report on smoking, women and smoking, which was the first ever report on that. So I had a real opportunity. The report on sexual health, which was quite controversial. You remember Dr. Jocelyn Elders was fired as Surgeon General because of her discussion of sexual health, something that we ought to talk much more about.
That's right.
And we could save a lot of lives there, too. So I just want you to know this is it's very special to me to be able to come here and meet with you. And I really like the give and take, so even though you've been asked not to ask questions while I speak, I certainly hope you will have questions when I finish. In Rochester yesterday, one of the things we did, which I appreciated, is we had a panel after my presentation of the people who had won the Satcher Award. Well, so those are reports from the Surgeon General, but these are the reports on mental health. There was the main report, mental health, the report of the Surgeon General. There was the report dealing with children and mental illness. Very important report, mental health, culture, race, and ethnicity, because culture gets really mixed up with mental health. And part of the stigma is directly related to the cultural issues that I think Ryan discussed and Carl. So this is a very important area. And I think what you are about to do in New York State is a major step forward. But I agree that it has to be done right, because sometimes you can do more harm than good if you don't do it right. But you have an opportunity to do it right. And the fact that you're here today is an indication that you're concerned about doing it right. I also released a report on suicide prevention. It's not up here, but it was a very special report. And I remember, Ryan, after I did that report, that I got a call from several people, but one was from a young man in his early 20s, and he said, he thanked me for doing a report on suicide and suicide prevention. And he told me that when he was 8 years old, his mother had died, and nobody would tell him why she died. She committed suicide. And so he was now 20-something years old, and he had never had a discussion within his family about his mother's death, never had. And so he decided after the Surgeon General's report came out that he was going to get his family together the next weekend and have a major discussion about his mother's death and about suicide prevention. It's really important for us to talk about these things. It really is, and so I was happy to hear that. So what is mental health? I mean, what does it mean to be mentally healthy? Here's the way that we define mental health, and most definitions are a little shorter, but I'm gonna have two tries at this. Later on, I'm gonna give you the four elements here, but let's just say mental health is the successful performance of mental functions, such that our activities in life can be productive. Very important, mental health is fulfilling relationships with other people. It's not easy. I mean, it's not even easy in the family to have these relationships sometimes. And so mental health issues begin to show up very early in life. And I believe in the family, it's where most of them show up. Now, we often say that when kids leave home and go to college, it's when they're most likely to be diagnosed with mental illness. And it's true, many, many of our young people, because of the stress, the transition of leaving home and going to college, will first be first diagnosed there. But clearly, by the age of 14, over half of people with mental disorders should have been diagnosed, and that's very important. Mental health is also the ability to adapt to change and to successfully cope with adversity. So that's our definition. That's how we define mental health when we released our report in November of 1999. Now, on a lighter note, this is the same definition, of course, but it's broken up into these four categories. Remember, we talked about productive activities, fulfilling relationships, the ability to adapt to change, which is one of the reasons I think that so many mental health problems show up first in adolescence. You think about all of the changes that people go through during adolescence, including puberty. So a lot of mental health problems are diagnosed during this period. Mental health is also the ability to cope with adversity. After Hurricane Katrina took place in New Orleans, I was asked by NIH to work with the city of New Orleans to rebuild its health infrastructure. And the interesting thing was that the percentage of people with depression in New Orleans and in Baton Rouge, for that matter, tripled the year after Hurricane Katrina. We screened, and 30% of the people were diagnosed as depressed, as compared with 10% beforehand. So clearly, trying to cope with adversity leads many people to being diagnosed as being depressed. it doesn't mean that they had never been depressed before, but certainly coping with adversity can be a real test of your mental health, right? So, and I think that's what that's about. Now, there's a story that we like to tell, and hopefully the policymakers here will forgive me, I'm trying to make a point. But the story is about a man who was traveling across the country in a hot air balloon. And at a certain point, he realized that he was lost. So he decided to lower the balloon to see if there were any recognizable landmarks. So he lowered the balloon, and he didn't see anything he recognized, no Golden Gate Bridge, no Gateway to the West, no Empire State Building, nothing he could recognize. So he just kept lowering the balloon. It was when he got to about 30 feet above ground that he spotted a man working in the field below. So he yelled out, "Where am I?" And the man stopped digging, and he looked up and he said, "Well, you're in a hot air balloon about 30 feet above ground." Well, the man in the balloon said, "My goodness, you sound like a scientist or something." And the man said, "Well, I am a scientist, but how in the world did you know that?" And the man in the balloon said, "I knew that because you're in the same position you were before, and now you're asking me where you are." So the man in the balloon said, "Well, you sound like you work in science." And he said, "Well, I do work in science. But," he said, "you sound like one of those policymakers from Washington, D.C. or somewhere. You don't know where you are, you don't know where you're going, and now you're blaming me." And you see why I asked the policymakers to. Well, obviously, the New York State policymakers know where they're going with this, I believe. They don't know all of the answers, but I want to assure you that you're headed in the right direction. Our children need to understand their mental health. They need to understand what it is. They need to understand how you enrich your mental health. And they need to understand the mental health of others. And I don't have to dwell on that because they are having to deal with the mental health of others every day. And obviously some of it now is more widely publicized. Children, it's difficult sometimes to diagnose mental health issues in children. In the Affordable Care Act, I don't know how well you read the Affordable Care Act that was passed in 2010 when President Obama was president, but the act was so important because, number one, it mandated mental health parity. In other words, insurance companies had to reimburse for the treatment of mental disorders the same as any other disorders. And it mandated addiction equity. It said that, addiction is a mental health problem. That's not to excuse people for being addicted, but it does say that some people are more easily addicted than others because addiction is related to our mental health. Well, for children, we have more difficulty defining mental health and mental illness sometimes. We certainly look at landmarks. I mean, are children talking when they should be? Are they walking on time? Are they delayed? And often mental health problems show up as a delay in reaching landmarks, milestones. The attachment of children to their parents and to others is one indication of their mental health. Satisfying social relationships and effective coping skills. Now, if this sounds to you like something that we ought to be talking about in adulthood, well, it is, because some of us continue to struggle with those things. But mental health is really critical in childhood. For some reason, that's not moving forward. Okay, thanks. That's it. But this is Chris Strasher, by the way, if you didn't meet him. Chris, as you heard, worked with us at the Morehouse School of Medicine for about 14 years. We did a lot of things together. He has recently joined the team of the Clinton Foundation, and President Clinton was in Atlanta a few weeks ago. But, and he also has money, I have to tell you that. So. He may not have had much money when he was with me, but he's with the foundation now. No, seriously, Chris has contributed so much to the work, our work at Morehouse, and I think now throughout the country. Children have temper tantrums. Temper tantrums, and I know most of you know that if you've had children. But when adults have temper tantrums, we have a problem, right? And some adults do. And those temper tantrums can be really dangerous. So developing the development of children can be a sign or a warning of mental disorders. We have a lot of people who suffer anxiety disorder. We have a lot of people who suffer mood disorders like depression, especially in our veterans coming back from Vietnam. There was one gentleman yesterday at the meeting who talked about his experience coming back from Vietnam and his depression. Many of them talked about having been addicted to drugs, and that happens often in veterans who have had very difficult experiences, and they deal with them when they get back sometimes by becoming addicted to drugs. It's not their intent, but when you use drugs to feel better, often you feel better, but you also get worse in terms of recurring depression and things like that. Thank you. And I didn't even ask you to sit there. It's amazing. I think I'm probably hitting something here to cause a problem. But there are several key risk factors for mental disorders. Prenatal damage, and one of the leadership development programs at the Satcher Health Leadership Institute at Morehouse, and I think we're the only institution that has a leadership program for parents. And the reason we have the leadership, you know, we have leadership programs for physicians and other health professionals. We try to help them to understand policy making because we need them to be able to understand policymakers making if they're gonna advise policymakers. But also, we think parents play such a great role in terms of child development, especially development of the brain. And so what we try to do in our leadership development program is to really help parents to appreciate how we can enrich brain development early in life. You know, most of that development takes place before the age of 2, 80% of it. And so if you're not getting the right nutrition, communication, stimulation in the early years of life, and that includes pregnancy, we encourage. The reason we say our program is from 0 to parents, is for parents from 0 to 5, is because there's so much you can do, even during pregnancy, to enrich child development, especially brain development. But we do have problems. We've had an increase in low birth weight. I don't know if 2 weeks ago, the New York Times had an extensive article about the risks that black women face during pregnancy and delivery, and the fact that we've got to get to the bottom of it, and we've got to prevent low birth weight, because infant mortality is also at increased risk when there's low birth weight. But difficult temperament and predisposition to mental disorders, external risk factors. I served on the World Health Organization Commission on Social Determinants of Health, and we released our report in 2009. And it was about social determinants of health. It was about how one's environment impacts his or her development and his or her health. So these unsatisfactory relationships, all of these things, of course, impact mental health. How can you intervene? What are the most important interventions when it comes to mental health? Young parents really need to know this, or young families. Parent education programs like the one that we're doing. By the way, we evaluated our parent education program as we had parents to graduate. And among other things, of course, we found that Black women who went through our program had a lower risk of depression. And so that was one of our first findings. But NIH, which, as you know, funds major research in this country and the world, was so appreciative that we evaluated our program, and we didn't just feel good about it. We actually evaluated it and found that depression went down. So NIH funded us to replicate that program in 12 states. So we now have 12 states, most in the Southeast, where we're working on educating parents so that they can be better parents. And the educational program for young children can be helpful. Nurse home visits. After the shooting in Columbine, and this shooting took place very soon after I became Surgeon General, but I hope most of you remember it. We shouldn't forget Columbine. 12 students were killed. The shooters killed themselves. And one teacher died on that day in Columbine. So we shouldn't forget it. We shouldn't forget what happened there, and we shouldn't forget that if we don't do a better job in educating our children, improving communication, as you well know by now, we're going to have more and more Columbine. When Columbine occurred, we hadn't had much of that. So most people remember Columbine. And of course, later on, Sandy Hook, and all over, of course, most recently, Parkland. Well, maybe even since then, there have been a couple more. It's a serious problem, without question. But after Columbine, we found that one thing that helped to reduce violence in communities was to have nurse home visits. And these nurse home visits would go on for like 6 months after the baby went home. They were helpful to the mother, they were helpful to the baby. And there was a reduction in violence in that community, in those communities. Primary care and schools, settings for early recognition of mental health, mental disorders, and taking a systems approach, looking at the mother, the child, the community, can be very helpful. Well, why is culture important? And this is important to remember that when it comes to culture, the patient is impacted in terms of how they manifest and describe an illness, how they cope with illness, the type of stresses they experience, and whether or not they are willing to seek treatment. I have to tell you, there are a lot of people who suffer mental disorders who have not and will not seek treatment, often until it's very late in the game. That puts all of us at risk, by the way. When people with mental disorders, depression, anxiety, anger management, when people refuse to seek treatment, or they're afraid to seek treatment because of the stigma, as somebody mentioned. The stigma surrounding mental disorders is a major barrier to people seeking mental health care, a major barrier. We can change that. Certainly New York State can change that. If you're educating children in elementary school, middle school, high school, if people are talking about mental health just as we talk about physical health, we can change attitudes. And when we change attitudes, people will be more willing to deal with their mental health challenges. But it is not just the patients who suffer from stigma. I'm embarrassed to admit this, but since I've been a little hard on policymakers, I should talk about healthcare professionals. We have a major problem. There are a lot of healthcare professionals, as Patrick Kennedy says, they do patient checkups, but not from the neck up. You know, they examine everything, but when it comes to really examining mental health, and we look at this very closely in our clinics and in the hospital, are people really paying attention to the mental health of patients? And patients go to the emergency room every day, and they go to community clinics every day without getting mental health checkups. So we pay a price for that. So mental health professionals must also be engaged. We've been trying to make sure that our graduates are prepared and motivated to provide that mental health care. So here are the key messages that were in the Surgeon General's report, and I certainly hope these messages are included in the educational curriculum for New York State. Mental disorders are real. Their mental health is fundamental to overall health and well-being. Mental disorders are as disabling as cancer or heart disease in terms of causing premature deaths and in terms of lost productivity. Mental disorders can impact those. In fact, the life expectancy of people with mental illness tends to be much lower than the rest of the population, about 25 years lower. And many of that is because not being diagnosed and not treated. And so behaving in ways that reduce life expectancy. Mental disorders are common. Our children need to learn that, and they need to learn it early. People are different. Some of us need help because we had trouble with our heart, some with our lungs, some with our brain. Mental disorders are real and common. The sooner we react to mental disorders, the better people are going to be in their health, and better the safer our communities are going to be, et cetera. Now, in our report, we said that 1 in 5 Americans has a diagnosable mental disorder each year. And I have to say now, at least 1 in 5. Most recent studies, I think at Harvard, concluded that it may be as high as 1 in 4. In other words, 25% as opposed to 20%. But when we did our report, we knew that 44 million adults suffered from a mental disorder each year, and almost 14 million children. It's a lot of people. It's a lot of people. And there's no excuse for our not responding to those kinds of data. But there was good news in our report also. The good news was due to the research that we have done and continue to do. Research has improved our ability to recognize, diagnose, and treat mental health conditions effectively. And yes, 80 to 90% of mental disorders are treatable, whether it's medication or talk therapy, a combination. People can be helped for mental disorders, and the sooner they get that help, the better. Very important message, and certainly when it comes to educating children, that ought to be a major message. We can treat heart disease, we can treat lung disease. Doesn't mean that it's going to be easy, but also we can treat mental health problems. I do want to focus on, I think many people remember that I put a lot of emphasis on physical activity when I was Surgeon General. In fact, started when I was Director of the CDC. And when I became Surgeon General, we released a report on overweight and obesity, a lot of discussion about the importance of physical activity. I want to make sure you get the message that physical activity is as important for the brain as it is for the heart, as it is for muscles. Physical activity is critical for brain health and development. Studies show that physical activity can reduce depression, can elevate mood. The people at Duke several years ago did studies to show that if you combine physical activity and medication for people with depression, you're much more successful at dealing with the depression. We also have done studies to show that physical activity improves mental acuity. Now, I have to say, we're struggling with an epidemic of Alzheimer's disease. And in most of our families, you know, we can point to somebody who is suffering. It has a lot to do with aging, of course. The older you become, the greater risk there is for Alzheimer's disease. And certainly in my own family, we had to deal with Alzheimer's disease. Well, we don't have any really definitive treatment for Alzheimer's, but we do know that people who are physically active, if they get Alzheimer's, are likely to get it later. in life than people who are not physically active. So I think it makes a little sense when you think about the fact that we have a lot of vascular disease. African Americans have more diabetes, more hypertension, and more Alzheimer's, twice as much. And so we're really trying now to make sure that we find a way to treat Alzheimer's, but in the meantime, find a way to delay it or prevent it. And I'm going to say it definitively that physical activity is important for the health of the brain from childhood to adulthood. And I'm a football fan, and I know many of you are, and I remember coming to Buffalo when we were doing the work on preventing concussions. A lot of our professional athletes are now suffering after their career from having had concussions. So we talked about chronic traumatic encephalopathy. I mean, we cheer when there's head-to-head contact on the football field, right? But inside that head is a brain, and that's nothing to play with. We've got to find a way, if we're going to enjoy football and soccer, and even basketball, because many girls have concussions while playing basketball. We've got to find a way to protect the brain. And I hope that's a major part of the curriculum in New York State. How do we protect the brain from injury when we're playing sports that increase the risk of injury? We can do it, but we've got to give it a priority. We've got to give prevention a priority. Studies show that physical activity improves sleeping. And I know a lot of you have trouble with sleeping. Everywhere I go, people talk about getting older and having more trouble sleeping. Studies show that physical activity reduces stress and anxiety. I know many of you probably use alcohol to reduce stress and anxiety, but I want to recommend physical activity. this is a very interesting picture because after I left government, I became involved with a program called Action for Healthy Kids. And we were trying to get the schools to return to physical education K through 12. And many of you remember that many schools cut out physical education, and they said they were doing it because they needed to spend more time on math than reading. And let me tell you, what this study showed is that physical activity improves math and reading. And this shows a brain after 20 minutes of sitting quietly, and a brain after 20 minutes of walking. And there's no question about the benefit that physical activity has on the brain. Okay, I'm moving toward the end. So that's the good news, right? I wish there were no bad news, but there is. Of all of those diagnosed with mental disorders, fewer than half of adults get help. Fewer than half. Now, why is that? We've talked about stigma, we've talked about other things, but clearly there's a problem here. But what bothers me even more is that only one-third of children, or less really, some studies show it's like 20 to 25% will get the help that they need. So hopefully one thing the New York State law will do will be to increase access to mental health care. So of the 20 million people in this country who have substance abuse disorders, and as you know, we have an epidemic of opioid addiction right now, right? Last year, 2016, I should say, we had over 50,000 deaths. And the current figures suggest that 2017, the number of people dying from overdose from opioids increased. And it's not limited to the United States, even though we started it like we did with the tobacco epidemic. It's now, Canada, of course, has a major problem, and other countries. So we need to really get on this one. Stigma is something that we have to work together to reduce. We have to, and I have to say, I don't know all of the things I need to know about the New York State law, but one of the things it should do, it should reduce the stigma surrounding mental illness and the treatment for mental illness. So I'm happy about that. I think it has the potential to do that. Stigma not only affects individuals who do not seek treatment because they're embarrassed or they don't want people to know they have a mental health problem, it affects the community. And so we have to become engaged in the community. Like you're doing here, this is a community meeting, right? But in the churches, we need to talk more about mental health and mental illness. And we need to work together to try to reduce it. And then, of course, this is a great place to say this, in New York. Stigma has kept policymakers from addressing this problem. It was not until 2008 that we passed legislation for mental health parity. Can you imagine that? But it's true. And so New York State has now become a leader in this area, and I'm hoping that this is going to spread rapidly in terms of policy. Well, I'm going to go lightly over these, but I want you to know that you don't have to be in the medical profession or in related professionals to help with this. We need help downstream when in terms of people getting treatment early and being referred. We need help midstream. We need people in the community to work together to create healthy environments for the brain, right? That's midstream. And then upstream, we need policymakers to make policy that will help to solve this problem. That's the so-called McKinley model. You can act downstream, midstream, or upstream in terms of policymaking. This is one of my favorite slides. We talk a lot about equity and equality, and as Surgeon General, I think some of you remember, I introduced the goal, of eliminating disparities in health. And we have made some progress. However, more important than eliminating disparities is eliminating the barriers that prevent equity. And at the Morehouse School of Medicine, our overall vision is leading when it comes to the vision of health equity. We need to all be working toward that vision. So New York State, I'm going to close with New York State here. Section 804 of the New York State Education Law declares that mental health as well as physical health be included as part of health education in the schools. Very important law, and I think it's what it's going to be implemented in July of 2018. The legislation was signed into law in 2016 by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo as Chapter 390 of the laws of 2016. And when it becomes effective in July of 2018, it will require all elementary, middle schools, and high schools in the state of New York to provide instructions about mental health to all students as part of the school health curriculum. Now, what's going to be important with that? Evaluation, right? There must be some way to evaluate the impact of this law on mental health diagnosis and all of the things that relate to mental health. Suicide, violence, all of those things we ought to be looking at very carefully to see how this law impacts. Because I want to hear your questions, I'm going to skip this about the Satya Health leadership. It's hard for me to do that, but I'm going to do it. But I want to say that today, the need for leaders in this area and others is too great for us just to leave it to chance. We need to develop leaders in this area and in other areas. But in the bottom line, we need people who care about this. We need people who care about children. I mean, who really care about children. We need people who care about mental health. We need people who are willing to study to know enough. I was just talking to one young lady here who told me that she's a nurse and she's decided to work toward a PhD in nursing because she wants to contribute more. We need more people who want to know enough. We must have the courage to do enough, and it does take courage. And finally, we must persevere until a job is done. It's critical. Now, this is the Surgeon General's prescription, and I hope you know about it. If you don't, all you have to do is go online and go to our website, and you can get a copy of the Surgeon General's prescription, which I actually developed when I was director of CDC, but when I became Surgeon General, wrote it as a prescription. When I was a student at Morehouse, and I noticed your podium here, I guess this is a part of the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the killing of Martin Luther King Jr. One of the things that Martin Luther King and I have in common, in addition to working in, he led the civil rights movement. I used to go to his church whenever I knew that he was going to be in town because he was co-pastor with his father. But something that Martin Luther King Jr. and I have had in common was the president of Morehouse College, Benjamin Elijah Mays. How many of you know that name? Benjamin Elijah Mays, great leader, motivated Martin Luther King Jr., certainly motivated me. And I want to close with a quote that I first heard from him. It's called God's Minute. I have only just a minute, only 60 seconds in it, forced upon me. I can't refuse it. I didn't seek it, didn't choose it, but it's up to me to use it. I must suffer if I lose it, give account if I abuse it. Just a tiny little minute, and yet eternity is in it. Thank you.